Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along. Sign up at greatgrowalong.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I am just pleased as punch to bring forth Barry Esterbrook, one of my very favorite writers. He's been on the show only a couple of times for Pigtails, I think was the last time. And I don't think I knew you when you published Tomato Land. But anyway, people should know your name in case you don't. Barry is a James Beard Award-winning journalist whose books include the aforementioned Tomato Land and Pigtails. And his latest book, Just Eat, One Reporter's Quest for a Weight Loss Regimen That Works, came out just last month from Lorena Jones Books imprint at 10 Speed Press. Welcome to the show, Barry. It's great to have you back. It's been quite a while.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Katie.
So the way this book, the genesis of this book was that your doc gives you the bad news that you have to lose some weight. Had you been a dieter before, or was that a whole new experience for you?
It was totally new. I didn't think I was the type of person who did things like go on diets. I'd been gaining weight probably since I graduated from university at about a rate of a pound a year. Mm-hmm. So it kind of crept on.
Yeah.
But I was plenty strong, and I sort of compensated for the extra weight, you know, that way. And it never really, the weight never really affected me socially, romantically. At least I hope not.
Well, you're married, right?
Professionally.
She didn't leave you.
professionally, whatever. But yeah, I went into see my doctor, have a family history of heart disease.
Yikes.
And although he's a very quiet, man and never comes across heavy-handed in any way, he basically said, look, I'm giving you all the blood pressure medicine I can. I'm giving you all the cholesterol medicine I can. Mm-hmm. You're maxed out. And you're going to have to lose weight if you want to get these two things under control. And it was sort of a come-to-Jesus moment. I did not want to follow the great family tradition of having a heart attack or a stroke prematurely. So
or ever.
I thought, okay, right, or whatever. Put whatever happens off, I guess.
Yes, you don't ever want to have either of those things. Right.
Right. So I decided to do something I'd never done, which was conscientiously decide to go on a diet.
So you explored a lot of diets, but how many diets did you actually go on yourself? And then how many did you end up including whilst writing the book?
Well, they overlap a bit. Mm-hmm. So I rounded off to around a dozen diets. If you're on a keto diet, for instance, you're also on a paleo diet.
Right.
And a gluten-free diet. I touched on about a dozen different diets and really focused down on three diets, because I found in my research that basically there are only three diets.
Right.
All the rest, it's a matter of branding, coming up with a clever name, South Beach or Paleo or, you know, Whole 30. They're just attaching a clever marketing name to concepts that were really developed in the middle of the 1800s.
Amazing, Barry. So first, let's drill down a little bit on the financials here. The diet, I mean, you had some extraordinary numbers in the beginning of this book. Tell us about how much money is generated by the diet industry as a whole.
It's over $70 billion with a B, dollars a year in the United States.
Do.
Put that in perspective. It's way more than we spend on fresh produce, for instance, or any sort of produce.
Wow.
It's a huge number. It individually breaks out. People are spending up to 80% more for the food they eat while they're on diets than they spend normally. Things like that.
Yeah, that blew
so
my
it's,
mind.
It's just an,
how are they doing that? It's because they're buying brand-specific stuff like Jenny Craig, or I'm trying to think of Weight Watchers. Or is it meal plans that they're spending all this money on, or is it just have to shop a whole new pantry in order to fulfill the requirements?
Both.
Okay.
I mean, you know, the meal plan things are, of course, very expensive. Weight Watchers isn't a meal plan, but you can buy Weight Watchers brand, fudgesicles and Weight Watchers brand string cheese. And they're more expensive than the standard stuff you get in the grocery store, which is essentially similar. So you notice anything in the grocery store that's fat-free or lean or anything is priced higher than normal stuff.
Yeah, right.
And yes, when I went on to a vegan scheme, I did have to stock up with a lot of things that I didn't usually buy, and they were expensive.
Yeah, because you end up having to go to
buy five different varieties of dried mushrooms.
Right.
Yeah. So it surprised me there.
Absolutely. Now, let's get busy with the first concept. You mentioned Whole30. That was your first diet. And I was interested to see that the principal people who were involved in creating this magical diet plan actually had no scientific education about nutrition or food. They were not registered dietitians. They had no degrees in nutrition. Would you say that is a fairly common, that lack of credential is fairly common within the industry?
I would say that they're probably an exception. Most of the famous popular diets of recent years, the inventors have at least been medical doctors.
Uh-huh, right.
But ironically, that's not saying a whole lot, because in medicine school, you don't learn a whole lot about nutrition.
No.
Doctors will be the first to tell you that they really, I interviewed Arthur Agatston, who wrote the South Beach Diet. And he said he knew very little about nutrition after years as a cardiologist.
Amazing.
So modern diets, you usually need to have some sort of credential just as a platform.
Right.
Even if your specialty, your doctor, the guy that invented the paleo diet, for instance, is a radiologist, an x-ray guy. He's Dr. Eaton, but, radiologists aren't nutritionists.
No.
And it goes on like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, absolutely. I see, that to me seemed like an overarching thread. Yeah, sure, you've got the doc credential, but anybody who's been in a hospital knows that nutrition and medical care do not go hand in hand.
Exactly.
It's axiomatic.
You just have to visit a hospital cafeteria.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and God forbid you're a patient. I mean, I think some hospitals are making, more of an effort to include whole foods, whole grains, slightly healthier levels of food. But I mean, I spent a week in the hospital in November, and I was served up Jell-O, and I was on a liquid diet, and I was served up things like Jell-O and broth made from a powder that was literally so salty I was gagging. I mean, it was, nothing was edible, Anyway, but I digress. This is not about me. It's about you.
You might have a new diet scheme there.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you one thing.
Katie's hospital food
diet.
Yeah,
really. You go on one of those liquid diets for a few weeks, you're going to lose some weight, homie. Oh, yeah. I lost 12 pounds in 2 weeks. and I have not put it back on. So there you go. But it was not a fun experience. One of the things that I loved was that you explored the myth of the cleanse. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the cleanse, but having a friend whose daughter just invested a large sum of money in her cleanse, I said nothing to her, but I want you to talk about the absolutely absurd notion of a cleanse.
Well, yeah, I went on something called the Master Cleanse, which is one of the popular cleanses out there. I went on it mainly because Beyonce went on it to lose money to or to lose weight to make a movie, and I came to the conclusion: well, maybe if someone's paying you tens of millions of dollars to do a movie, it's worth going on a cleanse. But otherwise,
yeah, starvation.
Yeah, so I did what. I did a cleanse where all that I quote-unquote ate was a lemonade made out of maple syrup, lemon juice, hot water, and cayenne pepper.
Yes, I've heard of that
and
one.
It tastes just it tastes awful.
Really?
The only good thing I could say about, well, if you combine the worst of all of those things, the sort of, you know, acid of the lemon and the cloyingness of the maple syrup and the peppery, sandy, gritty taste of the cayenne, you end up with what it's like. Mm. The only good thing I could say about it is after you drink it, you're not very hungry for a few minutes.
Yeah, right, right.
So I did that.
Yeah.
And then at the end of each day, I according to the instructions, I had a laxative tea.
Oh, nice.
It really worked.
Oh, yeah, I bet it did. Between the cayenne and what is that supposed to be cleansing you of? Like, what, you know, in the science behind a cleanse is what? You're supposed to be cleansing toxins of some sort? What are they talking about?
Wait, there is, if you ask any responsible researcher, nutritionist, there is no science behind a cleanse.
Thank you.
There's mythology that you're washing toxins out of your body. Well, you know, our livers and kidneys figured out how to do that a long, long time ago and are very efficient at it. So cleanses don't cleanse you. Cleanses don't cleanse you in the least.
Right, your organs cleanse you. But there's millions of dollars to be made in these juice cleanses where you, like, drink beet juice one day. I mean, it's really expensive. I mean, you can do the master cleanse, which is just starvation, but you can do these juice cleanses, which are very expensive, where they deliver it neatly packaged to your door. And there's, you know, New York City now has one of those places every other block, it would appear. But anyway, I just wanted to explode the cleanse.
Yeah, no, but you don't, you know, your body does all the cleansing it needs, so...
Of course.
So you're not cleansing yourself. You may be losing weight. You may be doing other things. You may be getting off booze or whatever it is that you're cleansing for, but you're not cleansing yourself at all.
Right. And you're also, with the laxative, you're also basically losing a lot of water weight. So you're going to look like you've lost 5 pounds maybe at the end of a week, but actually you've just lost a lot of water weight, right?
You lose water through the laxative effect. Yeah. You're exactly right. In fact, that's what probably the cayenne is doing. Mm-hmm. It's irritating your bowels, which causes you to flush them, your system to try to flush water through them to get rid of the irritation. But the other thing is when you're on a very low calorie diet, your system has to shift from burning glucose, sugar, as your primary fuel. Mm-hmm. For your metabolism, to glycogen, which is a chemical stored in the liver. And that's fine, but glycogen comes attached to water molecules. Mm-hmm. And when you use that glycogen, the water molecules are cast away. So you lose those along with, you know, as you burn that. And then the minute you go back to eating normally, your liver builds up glycogen again, and has to get all that water back in to hold the glycogen. So it's what you're losing is water.
Right. So yeah, talk about the yo-yo effect. Now, at the very beginning of the show, you said that there were essentially only three basic diets, and they were established first by Sylvester Graham, was one of them, William Banting was another one, and a woman named Lulu Peters. And everything since then has just been a variation on those themes. So can you take us through exactly what Sylvester Graham, William Banting, and Lulu Peters proposed in their, you know, 19th century wisdom?
Yeah, well, let's start with Sylvester Graham. He was a Presbyterian minister and firmly believed that you should eat a very bland, total vegetarian diet without spices, without coffee, tea, just a very totally carbohydrate and very bland diet. He did this for reasons of he was mortified about the people having high libidos and having sex, and felt that if you ate that type of diet, you would abstain from those practices. And so he came out with what essentially was the very first, you know, low fat, high carbohydrate diet, which lives on with, you know, Dean Ornish's diets, the Pritikin diet, a lot, any of the diets, even the American Heart Association diet, which advocates extreme, you know, fairly extreme low fat or close to it. So that was in the, you know, the early 1800s, early to mid 1800s.
Wow.
I should say, Graham, two things. One, he's still known through the Graham cracker.
Which I love.
That's named
I still
him.
Love a Graham cracker.
Right, yeah. I think he wouldn't approve of the modern honey grams and
yeah,
sugary things.
Not.
But
yeah.
His namesake, anyway, carries on. But he also died very young, very sickly. So maybe.
And yet the diet lives on. Incredible.
Any of those ultra low fat. High carb
diets,
avoid fats, avoid meats. Right, high carb diets are his offspring. And then this another great fellow, namely William Banting. He was a British undertaker and coffin builder, but to the star. I mean, to royalty. He was the high end. If you got undertaken by Banting, you were nobility.
Right, quality.
Anyway, he was about 5'6" tall and weighed a couple of hundred pounds and change. And he got so fat that he couldn't tie his shoes. He couldn't go upstairs properly or downstairs. He couldn't take care of life's little necessities, as he said. And so he lost weight by just doing the opposite. He went on sort of the first of the ultra low carb diets. He ate all the meat he could possibly eat, and basically no carbohydrates. And pounds dropped off, and he could get back climbing stairs again. He wrote it's really a pamphlet of about 20 pages that became an international bestseller.
Wow!
For a time in England, the word Banting, his last name Banting, was synonymous with dieting. It'd be like, I'm Banting to lose some weight. And he became, you know, world famous and, in fact, lived to a ripe old age. So, and then at about the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th, 20th century, scientists discovered the calorie.
Right.
A calorie is just a measure of heat.
Right.
Has nothing to do with food in and of itself. It's just a measurement, like inches measure distance, while calories measure heat. And it's the amount of heat required to heat water up by a degree Celsius. So after they discovered it as a sort of a physical notion, chemical notion, nutritionists, food scientists got a hold of it, and they figured out, well, they could calculate how many calories of food people needed to, say, lose weight, gain weight, do heavy work, do light work. And it became increasingly popular, especially after and during World War I, when there was a concerted effort for people not to eat too much so that the soldiers could have proper food. So don't eat more calories than you're supposed to. And also then the flapper era came in and everybody wanted to, you know, have a slim figure. It was no longer stylish to be portly or hourglass shaped. So people started counting calories. And this doctor from the West Coast, Lulu Hunt Peters, really popularized the notion of just, she basically said, you're no longer going to think about food. You're going to think about calories. You're no longer going to think about a piece of pie. You're going to think about 400 calories. And made that a popular way to monitor and lose weight. And it exists today through Weight Watchers or WW Internationals, it's now called, Jenny Craig, Noom, any of those things, which really are just ways for you to reduce total calories. You're not giving up carbs, you're not giving up protein, you're just limiting your calories. So those are the three basic diets. Cut out food groups, carbs, proteins, meat, or simply don't cut anything out and monitor your intake of calories.
Right, right. And then we can't leave this particular moment without having you describe the Fletcher diet and Fletcherizing, because the end product of Fletcherizing your food was to produce turds the size of a green olive, which I just found that so hilarious. So tell people what Fletcherizing is.
Well, you know, I'll happily do
what
that. The reason I went into all of these weird diets, though, is at the time, these diets were considered the peak of scientific, you know, nutrition. They were these were people who were taken seriously.
Yeah.
They wrote bestsellers. They were, you know, famous. It helps keep dieting in perspective. The diet you go on today may be like Fletcherizing. So Fletcherizing was basically you had to chew every bite of food you took at 100 bites, 100 chews, I guess, per minute at that rate, steady 100. And you had to chew it until it was completely tasteless, devoid of taste, and a sort of watery slurry.
Wow.
Before swallowing it. And it swept the world. People were, you know, you'd have parties of, you know, society women gathering around with stopwatches, counting them chews and not talking. And John D. Rockefeller followed it, Franz Kafka followed it, Thomas Edison followed it. And Fletcher himself, you're right, he had a disturbing preoccupation with his feces.
Yes, perhaps I've just demonstrated that I have one because I found that so funny.
I ain't saying anything, but he thought that by chewing so much, you prevented putrefaction of your food in your gut. The food would be properly prepared to enter your digestive system, and it would not produce putrid matter.
Right.
And like you said, he would have a bowel movement every 2 weeks.
Oh my God.
And he quote unquote about the size of a queen olive.
Yeah, right.
And he said it was totally inoffensive.
Yes.
No more offensive than, again, a warm biscuit. And the texture of clay. But he carried the proof around in his pocket in case
somebody
doubted it. He was ready to, you know, okay, you don't believe it? Here.
Last week's product. Oh, my God, buddy, that's unbelievable. But, you know, as you're telling me this, I'm starting to realize that right at the time that these diets began to become important, you know, these first three dieting, you know, gurus, as it were, was basically the same time as the Industrial Revolution began to sweep the Western, most, you know, Western countries primarily. I'm going to leave out the, you know, developing world. And that was at the same time when people began to not work outdoors as much, to not do as much physical labor, because machines were starting to fill in those labor, you know, efforts. And so people probably began to gain weight because not just, you know, I mean, I'm sure there were styles, as you said, the flappers and all that stuff, but people began to put on pounds because the level of activity probably began to decrease as machines took up more and more of everyday, you know, labor for just keeping a household running. What do you think of that theory?
Well, there were a couple of things going on at the same time. Yes, you didn't have to expend near the energy. I mean, think of, you know, what it must have been like before, you know, electricity came or anything. But at the same time, especially in the United States, we were producing enormous quantities of food. In the 1800s, you know, visitors from Europe were flabbergasted that even poor people in the United States were able to eat meat. And, you know, we were, the land was rich and the country was rich in food compared to other countries. So you had a couple of different things going on at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Combined with, you know, a sort of ethic that we really didn't have a food culture at all, not like, you know, France or Italy or Greece. And so we had all this food and we ate.
Yeah.
And ate and ate.
And anybody who reads old cookbooks for fun, which I often do, I have quite a collection of them, is, I mean, when you look at the sample menus that were being promoted to your average housewife, the quantity of food involved in each one, including breakfast, which would be, you know, beefsteak and potatoes and sausages and fried tomatoes. And, you know, it just was breathtaking, the quantity of food that you were encouraged to serve as a, you know, as a middle class housewife. I mean, that's what we're talking about. We have to take a short break right now. We'll be right back with Barry Esterbrook talking about his fantastic new book, Just Eat. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along, a three-day hosted virtual garden festival connecting you with the influencers, tastemakers, and cutting-edge content of today's gardening world. The Great Grow Along will feature 40-plus sessions on topics ranging from houseplants to DIY landscaping. New plant parents and first-time gardeners will gain practical advice and creative inspiration from celebrated garden experts and industry leaders. Costing $29.95, tickets allow attendees to mix and match a wide range of sessions, or choose to follow one of the conference's six tracks, which include edible gardening, urban gardening, pollinators and plants, DIY landscaping, houseplants, and dig deeper. The Great Grow Along will take place March 19th through 21st, 2021. Sign up at greatgrowalong.com.
Okay, let's move on, Barry, because we are horribly enough, we're running out of time. I don't want to keep you too long, but I do want to get on to the incredibly successful diets, the Dean Ornish diet, and sort of have you compare and compress Ornish versus South Beach and then South Beach versus Atkins, because my sister-in-law, for example, has been on the Atkins diet for a bajillion years at this point. She's been part of my family for over 30 years. She's never lost an ounce of weight, and yet she persists. She persists in not allowing me to serve a potato or a bean. So how does the science stack up on those diets?
Well, Ornish is kind of the most prominent now of the ultra, ultra low fat diets. He's primarily vegan. And all fats are kind of very much limited, including olive oil, vegetable oils, olive oil. So the diet is about 10% fat, which is a third of what the American Heart Association and the USDA say we should be getting. So you're eating, you know, a very lean diet. The notion is that that will prevent heart attacks and strokes and diabetes and a lot of the sort of conditions that are becoming increasingly common to this in this day and age. And I did go on it, and I did lose weight and gained it back again almost immediately, simply because it was, for me, it was too, I could stay on it, but it just required tremendous effort. And secondly, you know, it, and it's true with a lot of diets, there's no joy. There's no, I love to eat. It's you know, it's one of the blessings that everybody can have. And you know, I love sitting around the table. I love eating. And there's none of that in the program. So I eventually realized that I couldn't live that way. You know, it's like they say, it's easy to lose, live long. You just have to give up eating everything that makes living long worthwhile.
I'm not having any of that.
So then I spent a month or so on the South Beach diet, which is a low carb, high protein regime, sort of the opposite of Ornish. It was easier, and I did lose weight. But again, just following the diet was not, it wasn't the way I eat. You know, occasionally I want a sandwich. Sorry. Occasionally I want to come up from the office and slap a piece of meat between two pieces of good bread.
Yeah.
Occasionally I like to have an artisanal loaf of sourdough bread. Things like that.
Or a pizza.
A pizza.
I mean, please.
Or a good pasta dish. And these were gone. These were gone. So again, it was the same ultimate conclusion is, yeah, there was stuff to learn there, but I couldn't stick to that diet. And plus, it's a friend of mine who's been on it for a long time calls it the chop chop diet because it involves chopping so many vegetables and you're always cutting and chopping and whacking. There's no sort of, you got to have it'd be a great diet if you had a personal chef who did all the work. I don't happen to be in that position.
Some of us actually enjoy cooking, you know, so there's, you know, you don't want to make cooking too much of a job if you like to cook, you know what I mean? I mean, if you're not in a restaurant
you don't
setting
want to spend,
already.
I don't have a 45 minutes to prepare a complex salad for lunch every day.
Yeah, no.
You know, some days I want something quite simple. And then, so the Atkins diet is an extreme version of South Beach. They're all in that sort of banting, you know, it's okay to eat meat, don't eat
right, because so keto and paleo are kind of an extension of Atkins / South Beach.
Well, in fact, in Atkins's, you know, his first book, that introduced the concept, he uses, you know, exactly those terms. This was in the early 70s, so way ahead of them becoming popular. He mentioned that we should eat more like our paleo ancestors, plenty of meat, no very few simple carbs. And then he went on and on about ketosis, which is a scientific term for burning glycogen instead of glucose, ketosis is you know, that's where the name keto diet came from. He anticipated all those, and you know, all of these diets you'll lose weight. Most of them you will come out as a wash after. A year or so, you know, you lose weight on Ornish, you lose weight on Atkins, you lose about the same, and you'll gain it back in most cases.
If you don't stay absolutely, you know, committed to that lifestyle. It's essentially a lifestyle change, which brings me to Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, Curves, Noom. These are all diets where, first of all, you watch the calories, as you pointed out. It's part of the Lulu Peters, trio of, or the Lulu Peters school of dieting. But then also there's a big part of community in that. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, how the sort of the daily weigh or the weekly weigh-ins, the sort of rah-rah cheerleading aspect of it. Did you find that useful or helpful? Did that encourage you to stay on the diet? How did that play out for you?
Yeah, well, first of all, Weight Watchers has cleverly done away with the word calorie. Instead, they give each food points. Each food item has a certain number of points, and you're given a limit of points that you can have per day. It simplifies it, and it takes away the sort of clinical diety sound of calories. The fact is that for some people, it really works. It's one of the more scientifically tested programs, and if you're the right person, it works. You can be successful. It's expensive. It's going to cost you $700 or $800 a year just in sort of tuition to get the full program.
Wow.
But I really am not much of a group guy.
Right.
And so I found, it wasn't my solution. But, I would almost recommend people try Weight Watchers, because I have friends who do find that it works for them. They like the idea of going to these meetings once a week. And, you're with a group of people who all have the same issues. There's no shame in being a little overweight. And during my stay, I learned a lot by doing this daily counting, which now you can do on an iPhone app. Of points, I learned that I had some big issues that I hadn't really thought about. So I sort of found areas where I could cut back and stay within my limits for the day. Or if I didn't cut back, then I would inevitably exceed my limits. So it taught me a lot about my eating habits. Just this process of keeping track of everything.
Right, right. Interesting. So you've managed, that particular little nugget of, just like being mindful that, I think you made the point that you had been in the habit of, grabbing a bag of potato chips and a bottle of water when you got, filled up your gas tank or something. And through Weight Watchers, you looked at that and you thought, oh my God, I'm eating an extra 2,000 calories a week that I don't need to eat. I mean, it sounds very useful to know that.
Right. And it was a question of not giving it proper thought. Mm-hmm. We bop down to a little delicatessen gas station place near home and grabbed a sandwich and a little bag of chips. Harmless.
Right.
Until you realize those little bags of chips have, 300 or 400 calories in them.
Yeah.
Do that a few times a week. That's like having an extra day of eating. I flunked every diet I went on. I was a classic. I was a little upset about how, banal I am. Research shows if you go on a diet, you lose 5 to 10% of your weight, keep it off for a little while, and then gain every ounce back. And I was a master of doing that. I did it repeatedly. I did it a dozen times. It was getting depressing.
Oof, very depressing.
But then when I finally started looking at things and looking at where my big problems were, I realized I had learned a lot on every diet. Even though I failed, I had learned. On Ornish, I had learned, hey, there's nothing the matter with having 2 or 3 plant-based meals a week. It's not a sacrifice. I'd learned the value of you know, good big salads for lunch instead of potato chips and sandwiches. I'd learned, you know, one thing I learned was that for me, and it's not everybody by any means, it was helpful to quit drinking. I'm one of those people who finds it much harder, much more taxing to sort of carefully monitor, you know, pour out an ounce of this or a 5 ounce glass of wine. And I find it harder to have I find it harder to skip the second glass of wine than the first. So I finally said, to hell with it. To hell with it. I don't need the hassle. But that's me. Again, you know, what the ultimate answer is, you've got to look into your own eating habits, find out what will work for you, and go that direction. You shouldn't follow a diet. You should lead a diet. So the way to lose weight is to look at how you eat now every day. We're all a diet, you know, food eating is highly personal.
Sure.
And see if you can amend how you normally eat in ways where you'll be taking in less sugars, less simple carbohydrates, less alcohol, but still be eating your way.
Right.
And no one likes to be told how to eat, you know, starting from about age 6 months.
Yeah.
That is very true. You know, so what you're getting, somebody you don't know has got this template and they're saying, you know, a diet, and they're saying, here's what you have to follow. That ain't going to work.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons. If you look to yourself first and shift that, it's easy. It doesn't require willpower, and it started to work.
So in the end, how much, do you mind my asking, if you lost like the target weight that you were hoping to lose?
I'm still a bit of a work in progress.
yeah. Okay.
But the doctor wanted me to lose 40 pounds. And I'm down about 26, 28 pounds at the moment. And I'm still.
That's great.
But the main thing is, those problems, that high cholesterol and high blood pressure, they're gone.
Wow. So you don't have to take medication for those at all?
No, they're gone. You know, you don't have to lose a huge amount of weight to have tremendous health benefits. I intend to continue going down because I'm not doing anything. You know, like I say, it's requiring no willpower, no extra exercise. It's just looking into where I was making, you know, where those 40 extra pounds had come from.
Right, right. Well, I mean, they do say that your metabolism slows down a bit as you age as well, right? I mean, I was thin as a rake as a young person. And by the time I hit 50, well, that wasn't so true anymore. And I didn't really change my habits. my body, you know, pulled a fast one on me, basically.
Well, your metabolism slows down as you age, but it also slows down as you lose weight on a diet, which is another reason why for this yo-yo dieting phenomenon. So, weirdly, exercising a lot doesn't help you a whole lot losing weight.
Right.
But it's vital to keeping weight off that you have lost.
Very interesting. Yeah.
You know, and the reason it works is it boosts your metabolism. Do a bit of exercise.
Right, right.
So.
So, Barry, we're going to have to wrap it up, but I want you to promote yourself and your events. Like, where are you speaking anywhere? Are you doing any Zoom book touring? Or where can people, you know, find out more? Or basically just listen to you? Other events?
There's a fun event going on. April the 6th, where the Charleston, South Carolina Post Courier is having kind of a Zoom FaceTime session with several of their readers and anybody who've you know, read the book or are interested in this, just getting together for a big round table type of discussion.
And you have a website, Politics of the Plate, right?
Yes. Politicsoftheplate.com.
And you still maintain that you still blog on that?
Not so much anymore.
Well, you're going to have to get busy now, dude. You're promoting a book. Come on.
Okay.
Well, listen, Barry, it's been a great pleasure to have you on. I have to say, in your wildest dreams and in your long and storied career as a journalist, did you ever anticipate that you would become a diet guru of sorts yourself?
I always said that my whole career was based on people should know what they eat, should understand you're eating, and then make informed choices. I mean, we're sort of illiterate about food.
Yes, that's very true.
You know, the grocery store retail food industry loves that. So I just say, know what you're eating. Just understand the background. Give it a little thought. And when I went on that first diet, I realized that I was guilty of not, you know, of being mindless about what I was eating. I gave, you know, that first diet, I gave it no more thought than I do when I go in to, you know, pick up a bag of potatoes, not chips anymore, in the grocery store. Give no thought. So I thought, you know, you got to practice what you preach. And so I tried to turn those same skills, investigative and reportorial skills, onto the dieting phenomenon to see if I could learn something about what I was doing.
And you did.
And why diets don't work. And so it was different from what I usually do. But on the other hand, it kind of came from the same source, which is be mindful of what you eat. You owe yourself that much, and you owe the animals that much, and you owe the environment that much. Just be mindful.
Yeah. Words to live by. Barry, thank you so, so much for joining us today. Really fun talking to you, as always. And wish you absolutely all the best with this book. I hope it goes gangbusters for you.
Thank you very much, Katie.
You're welcome. And that's it for today. Thanks to my sponsor, and thank you all for tuning in. We'll see you next week with another great show. I think Leah Douglas joins me next week to give us an update on the meatpacking industry. So for those of you who've been following with Leah, you won't want to miss that episode. Thank you so much for listening. Bye for now.
What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking, and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.